This week we've got Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer, as well as a new Cool Mac Picks with Sam Levin. It's My Mac Podcast number 177.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com Podcast.
I'm Tim Robertson, publisher of MyMac.com, and this is, of course, the only Mac podcast where we do the entire show in the nude.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a nude podcast. Yeah. Did we tell you about that, Dave Hamilton?
See, I thought it was you do the beginning fully clothed, right? And then the middle section.
As the show goes on.
Optional. Right. And then clothing prohibited at the end. That's right.
That's right. Dave Hamilton, of course, from the Mac Observer, and he's no stranger to a podcast, that's for sure.
That's for sure, yeah.
But is he a stranger to nude podcasts?
No.
Nude podcast, that's the question.
No. Pants are optional with the Mac Geek Gab as well.
The other guy talking right now is Guy Searle, longtime co-host of this podcast. And, of course, before he was the co-host, he did, what was that segment called? Something about a dashboard. And, you know, I don't think it was ever 1 minute.
No, never was.
Never.
Ever.
But, of course, we didn't advertise that it was a 1 minute. We just said minute. We didn't say how long that minute would last.
Or how many minutes there would be.
Absolutely. And, of course, from the UK is David Cohen, staying up late to record the podcast. Hello, David.
Hello. And I'd like to say I might not be nude, but I am sat here in my pajamas.
Well, we can just use our imagination. I think that's probably good enough.
You're really just trying to scare Dave off, aren't you?
Got way too much information.
Now, you know, it's amazing that we've been doing this podcast for over 3 years, and we've never had, other than Marta Lara, we've never had anyone from the Mac Observer on the show.
Well, we're fixing that today. That's a good thing.
We're fixing it, absolutely.
And why does Marta Lara not count as much as, say, anyone else?
Well, because he kind of writes for us occasionally as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so, there you go. Okay.
So I never – well, I mean, when he was on the show, we said that, oh, yeah, of course, he's with the Mac Observer as well. But it was kind of one of those that, well, he's there and he's also here.
Right.
So
right. Absolutely.
So, but this is the official – the Mac Observer's visit to our podcast.
I'm happy to be
Yay!
Here.
Golf applause.
No. Guy is actually a huge fan of your show. He talks about it while we're recording a lot.
Yeah, I do.
Well,
I love the show.
Thank
you. As a matter of fact, you guys are coming up on 150 in about a month. Are you planning on doing anything special for it?
Hey, I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it. That's we missed our anniversary last year, so maybe
what,
I'll
show
make
100?
A note. No, we hit show 100, our 2 year mark last year, just totally breezed by us. And it was about, I don't know, 2 weeks later that I said, hey, happy anniversary, John. And he's like, oh, yeah. So we just, you know,
time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
We are having fun. It's, you guys know, it's a great thing to do. And John and I really enjoy, you know, getting together each week and doing the show. So it's
So why did you start the Mac Geek Gab? What was the reasoning behind it?
Well, that's an interesting story. Our PR guy at the time, Dave Parmet, had been pestering me. I guess this was January of 2005. In fact, it was January 1st of 2005. I was at his house and he was pestering me. You guys got to do a podcast. You got to do a podcast. And then he dragged me to a dinner at the Syndicate conference in New York a couple months later and drove home with him and Mike Dunn of Hearst Interactive. And on the way home, Mike was talking about it. And so I'm driving home from that thinking, I got to do something. And then at the time, we were planning on moving from Connecticut to New Hampshire. And one of the things that I would have missed from Connecticut was seeing John Braun regularly because he lives down there. And I thought, well, you know, maybe a podcast would be a good way for he and I to keep in touch. And additionally, I knew that doing a podcast by myself would, in addition to be, you know, putting all the burden on me, it would also be very easy to just let the schedule kind of lapse. So by having a scheduled podcast with someone else, you know, that gave it a chance to actually survive and be consistent and all the stuff that I knew I wanted out of it. And so that's kind of how it came up. It's defined itself. We just started talking about tech topics. I mean, you can go back and listen to the first shows. And then we started soliciting reader questions and feedback. And that's, you know, now become the focus of the show, is answering people's questions and really digging into the techie stuff and helping people out. So, yeah, we're enjoying the heck out of it.
Let me ask you a question, because you obviously started with Brian Chafin, the Mac Observer. Yep. Well, that was 1998?
Yeah.
What year was that?
It was 98, 99-ish. It was Webintosh in 98, and then we went through the process of acquiring Webintosh, found through during the due diligence process that that Dan did not own the domain webintosh.com, which made it kind of interesting to buy. Well,
so you started as a writer doing stuff like that, and then you got into podcasting. Do you consider yourself a podcaster now, or do you kind of podcasting is one of the things that you do?
Podcasting is one of the things that I do. I certainly am proud to wear the podcaster hat. I never did a whole lot of writing. There was a period of time where I did my Ask Dave column at TMO.
Yep.
But really, my function at TMO was to keep the ship running and keep the business going and, you know, get the ads sold and all that stuff. And of course, that's what Backbeat Media then spun out of was that piece of TMO. So, you know, I wear a lot of different hats. The podcasting one is that they're all fun, but that's perhaps the most fun. So it lets me flex my audio geek muscle at the same time as my computer geek muscle. And, that's a good thing. So.
Who would have thought back in 1998 that you could have your own internet radio show that's syndicated?
Well, Sean King might have. He was kind of on the
Yeah, but it was a little different then, though. True. I mean, it, at the time, you had to listen to Sean King's show live.
Right.
Or you can listen to it streaming on the internet later. But there was no way to take that show with you unless you capture the stream and burn it to a CD.
That's right. Oh, yeah. No, it's huge. I mean, the whole concept behind podcasting, take it with you, listen when and where you want. You know, it's beautiful. Awesome.
So let me ask you, what's your favorite Mac of all time, Dave?
Oh, wow. Man, that's a hard
question. Not including the one that you have right now. I ask everybody this question.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, the easy cop-out answer would be the first one, which for me was an SE30 back in 1989. Came with 4 megs of RAM and a 40-gig hard drive. And the little 9-inch black and white screen. And I mean, prior to that, I was an Apple II guy. So I had an Apple IIc that, ran a bulletin board on and did all kinds of crazy stuff with that we won't talk about. But, that SE30, you know, especially that first year with that SE30 really was kind of mind blowing. So yeah, I'd have to go with that just because of the experience that I had with it. As far as the machine that's the best, you know, I that's a hard question to answer. Maybe the Pismo.
Yeah, right?
You like the Pismo?
Yeah, I like the Pismo.
That was a great machine.
Yep. As far as hardware goes, at the time, that was a huge quantum leap up. You know, being able to actually have a machine powerful enough to be your main machine as a portable. I mean, that really changed my life, and I haven't gone back. So
It's interesting about the Pismo. I mean, because the machine that came after it, the titanium PowerBook, you still look at that now and it looks quite modern, whereas the Pismo kind of has that retro look.
Yeah.
And yet, many of the Apple people I've spoken to sort of still have that really fond spot in their heart for the Pismo, much more than the titanium machines.
Yep.
Yeah, the weird thing for me is my favorite Mac wasn't even made by Apple. It was a UMAC C600.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm not surprised. Those were nice machines. I like the Power Towers myself from Power Computing.
Right, right. Now, UMAX also had, I think it was the S900, which you could get in like a dual 604 configuration. It was just like some insane that, you know, no software supported, but by God, it had it.
So let me ask you, Dave, most embarrassing computer story that you can think of that happened to you, something you've done that you look back and you think, I can't believe I did that with the computer.
Well, for
not including bachelor parties.
Public consumption.
We'll leave that out. That's
yeah,
right.
Well, you know, maybe the first time I fried a motherboard. Well, there's two. So the first one's really easy. I had a 2CI that I was working on at Citibank when I was actually employed as gainfully by someone else. And went to change the RAM on it and totally fried the motherboard. I knew going in that, you know, I need to be careful of the dust and all that stuff, and totally fried it and had to have it swapped. The second was, I felt really bad about this. I had owned a Power 100, right? Mm-hmm. And, Power Computing. So one of the first ones that, that came off the line from Power Computing and had a client. This was down in Austin when I was doing some consulting. Had a client who had an SE30 and wanted to upgrade the RAM. And I said to her, okay, you know, we'll open this thing up, but with these SE30s, things get really, really particular inside. And there's a little piece of glass. And if you lean the wrong way or press the wrong way on either the motherboard or the case, and this little piece of glass on the back of the screen tube breaks, it's over. The machine's dead. And I said, you know, I really don't like working on these. And so, okay, fine. So in I went, working on the machine. All of a sudden, that telltale hiss, right? And then I wound up selling her my Power 100. So I kind of felt bad about that. But it, it really was, you know, it, it's just how it worked out. But it was one of those things like, gosh, this really looks bad that I go break her machine and then sell her my other one. You know, that's so.
Did you get a discount?
As long as you got a tidy profit, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, did you even charge her after that?
I think I did. Yeah. Yeah.
So insult to injury. Good.
Yeah, well.
So, Mike. Now you come from Austin, Texas. I know that's where Brian Chafin lives. Is that did you guys know each other beforehand, or did you guys meet because of the Mac Observer and getting that started? How did that relationship start?
Yeah, so I lived in Austin for about 6 years. Brian grew up in Colorado and Texas, and so was living in Austin. Brian's actually in the Bay Area now. He lives in San Jose.
Yes,
but. Yeah, we met down there as a part of a business that I had helped grow and had an interest in called Computer Nerds, where we were out there working and helping people with their computers and fixing problems and all of that good stuff. And Computer Nerds still thrives today. They're in, I think, 3 different states with 5 different offices now. And Brian came to work with us at Computer Nerds in a variety of capacities, and that's how he and I met. And then he presented to me the idea of acquiring Webintosh, which he was a writer for, and the rest kind of goes from there.
So you're also playing in a band, your own band, I know that, but you guys have a Mac band that you guys get together every year and jam at the Macworld Expo. By the way, I really enjoyed it this year, really enjoyed it last year as well. You guys do a great job. How did the Mac band guys get together? How did you guys start that up?
That was an interesting thing. You know, there were a bunch of us coming to Macworld Expo year after year, and actually twice a year at the time, right? We were doing the East Coast and the West Coast shows.
Right, the New York show too.
Yeah, and Paul Kent realized that, you know, there's all these parties going on, and at the time Paul wasn't with IDG, he was with Mactivity, which was the company that just was responsible for organizing and putting on the conference session. So he had nothing to do with the rest of the expo, but he was certainly tied in with everything.
Sure.
And he said, yeah, look, there's all these parties, and we all go to these parties, and there's a bunch of us that play instruments separately, but all play. And gosh, wouldn't it be great to pull this together? Now, prior to that, Chris Breen's band, the System 9 band, had played a couple of Mac the Knife parties, or Mac user parties, I guess. I was never at any of these. This was before my time as a, you know, quote-unquote insider in the Mac industry.
I think it was Mac the Knife. It was during the whole Mac Week thing.
Right. That's right. Yeah, it was Mac Week, Mac user realm. Yep. And so, you know, this concept wasn't new, but Paul kind of wanted to revive it and pull it in. And with the help of Eileen Hoffman, who was organizing the Mac the Knife parties at the time, kind of reached out and found all of us. I didn't know Paul all that well at the time, but Eileen kind of put me in touch with him, and we all sort of came together, and we loved it. And it, to be honest, it's gone way beyond just the music for us. I mean, it really has become it. It's a true band, right? We've got the camaraderie that's there. We help each other out as much as we can, and it's become a really wonderful thing. And the great part is, since we only play now one gig a year, there's no artistic differences or anything like that. We don't spend nearly enough time together to get sick of each other. So it's absolutely perfect. You know, we all say,
I tell you, every band, if we're not practicing that much, you guys sound great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we do. You know, we'll start usually end of October, beginning of November. We'll start kind of talking about a set list and different songs we want to add. And that's an email trail that goes on until about 3 or 4 days before the show. And then we get together once. We practice for about 6 hours in San Francisco. And whatever songs work, make it to the list. If they don't, that's it. And we hit the stage, and whatever happens, happens. So it's rock and roll, yeah.
Oh, what do you think about the Macworld Expos now compared to the way they used to be? I mean, I personally think they're a lot better than they ever were before. They seem to have lost a little bit of their innocence, but at the same time, I think they're a much better show than they ever used to be.
Yeah, it's true. You're right. They've lost their innocence. They've gotten smaller, although now they're getting bigger again, right?
Yeah.
But
well, so is Apple.
That's true. That's right. Yeah.
Well, at least their bank account is. I mean, if you look at the product line, it's a lot smaller than it used to be, but their savings account sure is a lot larger.
Yeah. Well, trying to be all things to all people, you know, they're concentrating on a core group of products and branching out into areas that just make more sense for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Now they're obviously going in great directions and doing very well, and their stock's even on the way back up, which is a good thing to see. So,
yeah. So let's talk about the Mac Observer a little bit. Okay. You said it started in 1999-ish.
Yep.
What was your role at the company at the beginning?
Yeah, so Brian came to me, obviously, with this idea and brought me in and said, look, I need somebody to manage the business side of things and also need an investor. So, you know, can that be you? And to be honest, it was kind of a lark at the time. It was like, well, it was a fairly cheap investment, and okay, you know, this is an interesting thing. Didn't really have grand expectations of it ever going to the point where it and the stuff that spun off from it would provide for me full time, but you know, something to do. And so you know, we did that about 8 or 9 months in. So Brian was in charge of getting all the content together and assembling writers and making sure that there was content on the site every day. And my job was making sure that that was possible, right? Having the servers in place, having any back-end systems we needed, and of course, selling the ads. I quickly found out that selling ads is not a job you can do while you're doing 16 other things, or at least not do it successfully. It's a job rooted in rejection, and so you just need to, for me, if I spent the morning doing ad calls and I got 20 rejections, be like, well, you know what? I got all this other stuff I need to do. So I'm just going to ignore this, the land of no and go and do the cool stuff. Well, the problem is, you know, the money doesn't come in when you ignore the land of no. And so I hired, Greg Snyder, who at the time was the VP of marketing at Mactel. Well, that company had folded and he was without a job. So he came to work for us at TMO, and instantly things came together. I mean, having a full-time salesperson made a huge difference. And right about that time, the folks from Mac Gamers Ledge and Mac Surfer and Low End Mac all came to us and said, okay, you guys have your stuff together. Will you do for us what you've done for you? Sell our ads, manage the servers, essentially take our headaches away so that we can, just publish the stuff on our site. And that's how Backbeat Media was born. And obviously it's grown from there. So
at which point did you know this was going to be your full-time gig and not something that you're just kind of doing on the side?
Well, we were very fortunate to start this all, right at a time when internet ad sales were kind of at a peak. I mean, it obviously fell off from there, but it was great because for the first year and a half, 2 years, we were order takers. I mean, the money was just flowing in, which was good. Then it stopped very abruptly, but during that time was the time that my wife and I decided to relocate again from Texas back to Connecticut to be closer to family. We'd had our first child. And so it was a natural time to say, okay, well, I've got to stop doing the consulting in Texas, at least, you know, on a large scale. And yeah, this other thing's bringing in enough money to where I don't need to hang my shingle consulting in Connecticut. So I'm just not going to do that right here, right yet. And so at that point, yeah, it became my full-time gig. Then things kind of fell off. I supplemented my income with a little bit of consulting as we kind of hunkered down. And you know, the downturn really was a good thing for us because it allowed us to really optimize our processes and get stuff that now we've been able to scale. And as the market's kind of, you know, gotten some solid footing, even though we're in, you know, heading toward a recession or seeing ad spending as a whole diminish, the online sector is actually seeing it increase slightly this year so far, which is good.
Well, more and more people are getting online to get their content rather than television, radio, or magazines.
Yeah, dollars are being pulled elsewhere, and they're keeping their money online, which is great. I'll take it. Yep.
Absolutely. Okay, now, the next part, I'm really kind of curious about this.
Okay.
Are you naked yet?
Well, I'd be crossing the TMI line.
I couldn't let it go. I had to. I had to bring it back there. So Apple has this new little device out for about a year called the iPhone.
What's that?
I'm sure you have one. It's called the iPhone.
Huh.
It's kind of a neat little device.
Yeah.
But seriously, do you see the iPhone as an extension of the Macintosh, or do you see it as it's completely its own thing, its own niche market out there? I'll start off by saying I see it as part of the Mac market.
Okay, interesting. I think to Mac people, it's part of the Mac market. But there are plenty of people out there using it and or salivating over it that have no interest in the Mac, and yet the iPhone is the perfect solution for them, especially now with enterprise support being brought to it, right? It may be 6 months from now that the iPhone is far more of a quote-unquote enterprise-accepted device than the Mac is.
Mac. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but isn't the iPhone, isn't it a Macintosh when you get right down to it?
Well,
yes,
sure.
It has a different input device, but it is a Macintosh.
Yeah, it's running OS X. I think Apple has very carefully not called the OS Mac OS X, right? It's just OS X on the iPhone. But yeah, I mean, it certainly leverages all of that stuff that they've built over the years, and it's way more of a computer in your pocket than most of the smartphones out there, and obviously we have yet to see the full benefit and the full impact of that, and the SDK and the next year will show us, you know, a glimmer of that. So
this time next year I think it's going to be a totally different market.
Yeah, I hope so. I can't use iPhone app.
I think BlackBerry is definitely looking in the rearview mirror, and they're seeing it coming.
So they've been looking in their rearview mirror for a while. What was that, David?
I think RIM's problem is that RIM is making the same mistakes that Palm made a few years back, which is
they haven't innovated.
Yeah, they've built a very successful product line, and they think it's like a golden calf. Let's not change it too much, because otherwise we might lose our audience. And they've just allowed themselves to be left in the dust.
Yeah, they've stagnated, whereas a company like Apple is innovating.
Exactly. Right? And I think the other thing Apple has been very smart with the SDK is by only allowing you to develop for the iPhone on a Mac. Because when the enterprises really get into this, and even in my own consulting business, I'm starting to see this now. People are saying, okay, well, the iPhone's going to be enterprise supported. So what does that mean? And when you sort of say to people, well, okay, well, that, if you want to develop for it, you're going to have to get some Mac developers in. They're not, in the past, they would have gone, oh, well, we just can't do that. Now they're saying, oh, okay, maybe we'll have to think about looking into that. You know, they want to develop for it, and it's going to be a Trojan horse that's going to bring Macintoshes into the enterprise, but of course is going to boost enterprise Mac sales. So, it's quite a savvy move, I think.
This time last year, of course, we all knew about the iPhone. It hadn't been released yet, but we had seen the first glimpses of it at the Macworld Expo. Who would have thought a year later we'd probably be more excited about the future of the iPhone than we were then?
I'll raise my hand and say I would have. When it was announced, I saw it and thought, man, I would love to want to get one of these, but I don't see it yet. It won't work for me. It's too limited. It won't do the things that I need to do. It won't be flexible the way I need it to be flexible. But I think down the road that's going to change, and it is changing. Oh, yeah. I look forward to the day when I can say, yeah, you know what, the iPhone is the right device for me. Because right now it's a Trio 650, and though the browser on it sucks horribly, everything else on it works really, really well. To the point, I got my wife an iPhone because we obviously needed to have one in rotation here. She's frustrated with it about all the things that I would be frustrated with. The mail app is kind of pedantic. The calendar.
You can't delete anything but one item at a time. I hate that in the mail application.
And you can't file things without opening the message first. Some stuff that it's like, yeah, I can appreciate why they did it the way they did it, but please, someone out there, develop a mail client that works for the rest of us, so.
You think that's going to be out on day one when the Apple Store, the iPhone App Store goes live? You think someone's going to develop a better email application for it?
I think there's enough people out here that want it,
Apple allow it?
Yeah, I think Apple will allow it.
I think they will too.
Yeah,
sure. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're selling you the mail application. They're selling you the iPhone. They don't care if you use mail on the iPhone or not.
In fact, if somebody develops a better mail client and makes available, then it's a double win for them. People will buy the iPhone on the back of the better mail client, and also they'll get a piece of that as they sell it through the iTunes store.
Or they'll just buy the developer.
Yeah. That's what
Palm. So where do you see? Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what Palm. So where do you see the Mac Observer another 10 years from now, Dave?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We're obviously morphing. The whole industry is morphing. Will it become, you know, the Apple Observer or something like that? I don't know. I think there's plenty of room for the Mac. Obviously, the Mac platform is growing leaps and bounds. We're seeing pretty decent growth here at TMO. I think we'll still be serving a user base. I think it's going to be a much bigger user base, certainly in numbers.
And demographic, probably.
Yeah, and the demographic is changing. It's very interesting to see the types of people that we have now versus the types of people we had, you know, 8-9 years ago. So, yeah.
Does it concern you at all, Dave, that the user base might be diluted as it gets bigger? I mean, at the moment, you know, it still has a very much a community feel, and it always has had. But obviously, as it becomes more mainstream, more mass market, there's a risk that that might fade away. I mean, what's your view on that?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a concern. I think there will always be the subculture of people that see the Mac as that cult following thing that they really, you know, that they care passionately about. And then certainly there will be people that just use it because it's a tool. I mean, we have that now. We've always had that. By and large, the percentages have been, well, more of the people are these cult-like folks. I think that's going to switch. I think we'll have more people using the Mac that are just using it as a general purpose tool and don't care about sites like Mac Observer or, you know, the podcast. They don't care about the news about the Mac. They just want to use the Mac. But I think the audience for a site like TMO or a podcast like this one will continue to grow in number, even though the percentage may actually diminish.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you're right on. Well, we want to thank you for coming on the show this week, Dave.
Pleasure.
All the best to the Mac Observer, the Mac Geek Gab, and, of course, selling all those thousands of ads and making millions of dollars.
On Backbeat Media.
On Backbeat Media. Absolutely.
We try.
We got a new segment from John Nemirovsky coming up. Then we've got a cool Mac Picks. And when we will return with our buddy Lee.
We're delighted on this edition of All Over the Mac at the MyMac.com podcast to have our colleague David Weeks. And I understand that you and your wife, Nancy, have just acquired a MacBook Air. Is that correct?
That's correct. For the longest time, Nancy has been stealing my MacBook Pro and not letting me use my own computer when I need to use it in remote parts of the house. So we went to the store, and I tried to steer towards the MacBook, but she said no. She wanted to spring for the extra bucks for the MacBook Air because it was so small, light, and portable.
But is she a road warrior? I know you're an airline pilot in real life. Is she an airline pilot also, or a truck driver or something?
No, she's retired from a career in the financial industry, but her Mac use is pretty straightforward. She's not a high-powered user. It's web surfing, email, and light word processing.
But why doesn't she use your desktop professional Mac Pro while you're out flying planes across the world?
Well, I think the expression, when you pry my cold, dead hands off the keyboard, comes across every now and then because I am on the computer probably excessively when I'm home. She often likes to surf in the morning and evening in the far corner of the house in a area off the bedroom.
But how did you manage the wireless situation? Since I know your office is about a half a mile away from your bedroom in your house, how are you able to get the signal all the way to the back corner where she likes to hang out?
Well, as we know, the reception on Apple's MacBook Pros with the metal frame is not particularly good, and we had zero reception in the bedroom reading area with either the MacBook Pro or the MacBook Air. It was just too far, given the mediocre airport wireless performance of the two computers. So I dropped $99 on an Airport Express, and 5 minutes of configuring later, we get plenty good signal off the bedroom.
Now, did you buy this computer locally at our Apple store here in Tucson, Arizona?
Yeah, the La Encantada Apple store.
And how was the service and the sales and the support?
Impeccable as usual. It was interesting that The MacBook Air is, while it's Nancy's first computer, it's about the 9th or 10th laptop from Apple that I've had. And I had a little trouble getting it set up. Some files were reluctant to copy. I got everything going. 2 days later, the machine went DOA because the hard drive refused to spin up. And I pulled all my technical troubleshooting tips and no luck, called Apple Tech Support, waited on hold maybe 5 minutes, and they walked me through the same things that I'd already done. And the conclusion was, it's dead, Jim. So I took it to the Apple store the next day and told him what I did, what Apple did. He looked at it, tried one keyboard command, and he said, it's dead. They walked to the back, handed me a new MacBook Air, and I was home in 30 minutes. My only regret was I had not backed up the machine after spending 5 hours configuring it and doing all the updates. So the second thing I did after getting the new one reconfigured was to put Time Machine on and hook up a USB hard drive to it and get it backed up.
Now, was it easy to get Nancy's personal data and her applications and bookmarks and email and all of her personal stuff from either your desktop, your Monster Mac Pro, or your MacBook Pro that you use when you travel? Which computer had her identity on it?
Nancy has an account on the desktop Mac Pro, and with the MacBook Air, Apple provides an upgraded version of the Migration Assistant, and it was, as I mentioned, troublesome with the first proven to be defective MacBook Air. I had a hard time getting the migration to take, and I had to move some things manually. Interestingly, on the second one, I used the 802.11n capability, not the wired Ethernet. We got the $29 Ethernet dongle. It was flawless. Everything came over. No muss, first time. And I was very pleased with the fact that I had to do virtually nothing to make her accounts identical. I think I had to set the desktop picture, and that was about it.
So is there a probability that the first computer actually had something defective, which is what caused it to be so difficult the first time?
I think the drive was going even as it warmed up out of the box.
But you got the base model, which is about $1,700 or $1,800, right? You didn't get the one with the flash drive?
No, we got the standard one, the 80 gig 4200 RPM drive.
And does she run it on battery power or does she run it on electrical power?
A lot of battery power. I conditioned the battery per the Apple instructions, charged it up, ran it down to sleep, charged it up, ran it down to sleep. I just did that by putting a couple songs in iTunes and telling it to to play until there was no more juice left. And the battery life with the screen most of the way, but not all the way up, and wireless is pretty close to 4 hours. It's certainly adequate.
What do you and Nancy think of that bright screen with the gloss? Because neither of you has ever used a gloss screen before.
Well, seeing as that's the only choice you have, there's not a lot of choice to make. I was initially a little nervous about the glossy screen, but actually after having seen it, it's pretty nice. The only thing is, be forewarned, it is very prone to show smudges and finger marks and bits of things that come flying out of your mouth. And, you know, so make sure you cover your mouth with a Kleenex because the glossy screen will show every mark on it.
Did you buy AppleCare extended warranty?
No. You have up to a year, which is the Apple's stock one-year warranty to buy AppleCare. So we're going to see how it goes.
How much is the AppleCare warranty on that?
Haven't priced it out, but if it's like the other ones, it's probably $3.25, $3.50.
Okay. Because on the MacBooks, I think it's the pricing of the old iBook, which was $2.50, and that can be got at $50 less from Amazon, and I think also
eBay is your friend.
Yes. So you'll make that decision at some point. You're not too worried about that at the moment. How many minutes?
We also purchase it with a credit card that doubles the manufacturer's warranty.
How many minutes or hours a day does Nancy use it? Or how many would she admit to using it? You're not here.
Well, I haven't woken up at 3 in the morning and found her, you know, in the lounge area off the bedroom surfing wildly. But it will get, you know, usually 2 hours a day used sometimes, and then none the next day, then another hour or two. And she uses it in the morning and in evening.
Is this the first computer that Nancy, your wife, has had exclusively for her own personal dedicated use?
Yes. Of course, she won't maintain it. I have to do that.
How many times a day does she come to ask you questions about how to use it?
Fewer and fewer. Not very much.
So you can see that as being a definite advantage.
Yes.
That's great. So what do you recommend for people who are on the fence as far as the MacBook Air? versus either the MacBook or the MacBook Pro? What are the major advantages and disadvantages of the MacBook Air with size, weight, shape, anything, the dark keys that I was concerned about, any concerns at all?
The MacBook Air was the first time I'd used, you know, the Apple chiclet-style keyboard for any length of time, and it really doesn't bother me. I prefer the one on the MacBook Pro, but the Air keyboard is fine for my incredibly bad typing. The machine's gotten a lot of bad press about it's too slow, the disk is too slow, you can't do this, you can't do that. If you compare this with a state-of-the-art machine two and a half years ago, this is right up there. You're not going to use this for heavy-duty Photoshop editing. You're not going to be running five applications simultaneously. But for the average user who uses applications, you know, in serial fashion rather than parallel, it's perfectly adequate. The disk drive is a little bit slow if you're doing big, big saves. There's a minor slowdown, but I'm pretty demanding. Nancy doesn't notice it at all.
And so she would give it an A+.
She's thrilled. She said, "I don't need all the other gadgets that the MacBook Pro or the MacBook have. So we'll use the wired Ethernet from time to time. And other than that, she's good to go."
That's good. So would she give it a perfect score, 5 out of 5?
Yes, and 6 out of 5 for the tech support that I provide.
A lot of our listeners have other computers, and either they or people they know would be considering getting the MacBook Air. What sort of person is the MacBook Air really best for, from your limited but personal experience?
Some people have said that the only people who would buy the Air are people who have more money than brains, but we're walking a living proof that that's not true. It's very portable. It's incredibly ergonomic. You can just carry it around like a, you know, like the manila envelope that it fits in. If you're going to need something on the road that's a desktop smashed into a smaller form factor, then you're not going to want it. But probably for 70% of the laptop users out there, if they switch to the Mac Pro for 2 weeks, or I'm sorry, the MacBook Air for 2 weeks, they'd find that they didn't really miss the features that they're not using.
So the weight and the size are huge advantages.
Very much so.
Very good. Well, thank you, David Weeks, and we can't wait to talk to Nancy. She's not here at the moment, so next time we get a chance to talk to her, we'll get her side of the story. So thank you very much, and we're delighted to have you here on All Over the Mac at the MyMac.com podcast.
Glad to be here.
And we're back with Sam Levin and Sam's Cool Mac Picks. Hello, Sam.
Hey there. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I've got a ton of stuff to review for the Macintosh, but I hear you've got a lot of cool stuff that I'm going to want to spend money on soon.
Oh, absolutely. And first up is a really cool company called iLove. And iLove makes a lot of lovely, no pun intended, products for the Mac. Actually, probably you could use them on the PC as well, but iPod, iPhone specific. Their cool new product is called the iLove 1155, and it's a DVD and iPod player with a built-in 8.4-inch screen.
Wow.
So if you're on the go, guys, and you've got a DVD you want to watch, you can watch it. It's built in to this device as well as iPod functions. So your iPod video, your iPod Classic, your older 5G iPod will all fit inside. You can carry it with you. It's a built-in rechargeable battery, and it's got a stand, headphone port. It's a pretty cool little device. You can obviously it's got line in, and I think they've done a nice job. It's $249. If you go to i-love.com, it's on the site, so just check it out. I think it's a nice little product. They're one of the few companies that have built kind of a multifunctional portable viewing device like this. It's an entertainment product. Next up,
sounds like it's one of those portable DVD players, but for the iPod.
It is exactly that. I believe the limitation is iPhone. You can't use the iPhone with it, or I believe the iPod Touch. But everything else, it's a nice product, and they have an array of other products. And we'll feature those over the next couple months. Keyspan is the next company I wanted to talk to you about. They were one of the first on the scene with a digital media remote. You remember that, guys, the DMR? It was a little infrared. Well, they've taken their technology, and I think they're one of the best with remote technologies, and they've created the Keyspan Presentation Remote Pro. Now, this little remote, it's a small little stick. It's got an embedded USB connector, and that's how it gets its wireless connectivity from. Built into the stick, And that same controller has a laser pointer. You can control your Mac as a mouse. You can use it as a pointing device. It will work with iTunes, PowerPoint, Keynote. For presentations, this is the product you've got to have. It's really nice. It's $79. And they had one before it for the last 4 years that was a great product. This is even better. It's available from keyspan.com, and retailers carry it as well. But if you ever want to do some really cool presentations, this is the product. Works on PCs as well. And then last up, well, actually, there's two more things. Kensington makes a cool, cool product called the Kensington Portable Power Pack. Now, you guys have seen battery, self-standing battery packs, right?
Sure.
Well, this is the size of maybe 4 or 5 credit cards sandwiched together, a little bit longer than a credit card, and it will power almost any portable USB devices. That means your iPod, your PSP, your BlackBerry. And by the way, it powers an iPhone or an iPod Touch. It'll literally juice the entire device. So how many of you guys have run out of juice on an iPhone?
All the time.
Everyone. Yeah. And you're hosed. When you run out of power, you can't do anything. This is a great, great device. I carry it everywhere. It's got battery indicator on it, so it tells you how much juice you have left. You can buy multiple different tips for different devices, and I think it's well worth the $59. It's $59.99, and Kensington has been designing products for the notebook line for years. So I think it's great. I've been using it for the last 2.5 weeks. And then last up is MCE Technologies. MCE, everyone knows in our Mac space, as doing legacy products for older Macs. But they also make some cool digital imaging products, and I'm sure you guys know about these guys. Their new product is called the QuickStream DV-HDV. So what they've done, they've had the original QuickStream, but the QuickStream is a intelligent FireWire hard drive that mounts on your video camera bracket where the flash mounts, the hot shoe is, and it gives you a ton of extra hard drive space. So for you guys that are prosumers or really into pro video, this is a product that's a must. A lot of videographers use this. It comes in two form factors, a smaller and a larger hard drive. It's $7.99 or $9.99, but it's a screamer for the video transfer rate. You just take the hard drive and you can plug it anywhere and to any FireWire port. And it's incredibly useful. I've heard from many, many people that use this product that they can't live without it once they have a QuickStream.
And how much does that cost?
$7.99 for the smaller version. I forgot how many gigabytes it is, but it's basically a small portable hard drive, or $9.99, but it's got intelligence built into it for monitoring how much is left on the hard drive. They've been doing the QuickStream for many, many years, for probably at least 6 to 7 years, and this is their latest incarnation of the QuickStream. If you check out mcetech.com, they have a full data sheet overview of what it is and what it entails. This is one of the best things MCE has ever made, besides hard drive upgrades and optical stuff that they do. They support almost every Mac on the planet as far as their products, and they're well known, well trusted in the Mac space. But for videographers, you guys have to check this out. It really is well done.
So this will basically turn any camcorder into a hard drive camcorder.
Well, exactly. As long as it has a FireWire output.
DV, exactly. Yeah. DV, it's got to be a. You know, you're not gonna go spend, $2.99 on the budget, whatever camcorder. This is for people that have a serious penchant for doing high quality videos or need that extra storage when they're on the go. They're gone on a biz trip. I've spoken with many people that use the older one. He's retooled it, made it a little bit more compact. Just check it out online. I think Arnie's the CEO. He's done a wonderful job. And I use a bunch of MCE products. I don't have this yet because I don't have a DV camcorder. I use digital cameras right now. So I will pretty soon. But check it out. I think you guys will love it, and any of our listeners would love to have it as well. And we'll try to get them a special deal if Arnie allows us to.
That would be great. You can find all the links to the products Sam talked about today on podcast show number 177 up at mymac.com. Thanks much for the cool Mac picks this week, Sam.
Got it, guys. Peace.
Thank you very much, John and David. Also, Robert Hazelrig sent us some feedback. He attended the Adobe Photoshop Express beta meeting, and he sent in some information about that. So let's give that a listen, and then we'll be right back with Lee Givens, Guy Searle, David Cohen, and myself.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig here. Today, I'd like to talk to you about a brand new application from Adobe. In case you haven't heard, Adobe has just released a brand new version of Photoshop. It's called Photoshop Express. It is a Flash-based web version of Photoshop for consumers. And it's free. Right now, it's in beta mode, but is fully operational. Adobe Photoshop Express is the complete solution to get your photos up and out online. With a simple drag-and-drop feature, you can upload your photos as high as 10 megabytes to the site where you can use their 17 tools to crop, rotate, reduce red eye, as well as move your photos, I should say, to places like Facebook, Picasa, and PhotoBucket. Adobe Photoshop Express also has several non-destructive filters, such as autocorrect, pop color, and distort. But I believe its most powerful tool is its touch-up healing brush, which you can use to retouch your photographs. All of the tools are incredibly easy to use, and many of them give you thumbnail previews so you can see how your editing will look before you've applied your filter or edit. Now, of course, I haven't used Photoshop Express firsthand yet. The beta release was just announced today, which is March 27th. But Adobe did give me a personal product tour last week, and I think this is very exciting news and wanted to share it with you. Thank you for listening. This has been Robert Hazelrig.
And we're back. Thank you very much, Robert Hazelrig. Adobe Photoshop Express, we're going to talk about that in just a second. But first, I want to welcome to the show Lee Givens. Hello, Lee.
Hey, everybody.
Long commute home, I take it.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. We have spring break for the local county schools, so it's not too bad, but still, it's a long commute.
Yeah. We had Dave Hamilton a little while ago on, and of course, that was a fun interview. He's with the Mac Observer, so when you go back and listen to the show, you'll get to hear what we were doing before you joined us.
Oh, great.
So Adobe released Adobe Photoshop Express. Let's start with David Cohen. David, what do you think about this? It's a Photoshop Lite on the internet. You can use it right from your web browser.
Yeah, I mean, it has, if anybody's used Adobe Lightroom, it has very much the same sort of look about it. They're using web technology to give that same gray and black kind of look to the application. I don't know what they've written it in. I presume it's using Adobe Air or something like that.
I would imagine.
To drive all of this. But basically what it is kind of like a gallery and simple online photo editing application. It's really focused around it looks very similar to the sort of thing you get on .Mac if you've got the latest version of iPhoto. But effectively you don't need the local client. It does everything online. And you get 2 gig of space to load your photos up, and you can just sort of drop them in and you know, create, set up your albums and galleries and do them online. It looks very, very nice. I mean, it really does act like a local application, even though you're online, you're up in the cloud. And it's interesting that they're experimenting this area.
What do you think, Guy? Is this something you're interested in?
I haven't really had a chance to take a look at it yet. I'm interested in many things along this line, and you know, I'll kind of wait and see how it works out.
What do you think, Lee? You think this is going to be a Flickr killer?
I don't know. I've been reading a lot about, you know, Flickr's, it's the Flickr anniversary, and they're thinking about getting in a video. I think the main reason Adobe came out with this is to really prove out how you could build rich media applications using the Flex platform. They want to show that, you know, they want to show a little, you know, if you really think about it, Adobe's been kind of getting through the Macromedia merger, and this is like one of the first big fruits of that merger. So I think it's something to say about all of that.
You think that this is more about photo, Adobe, I should say, getting into the online space as a developer rather than just a content provider?
Yeah, I think they need to they're trying to extend the brand. So Photoshop, you know, with Elements, Express, with you know, Creative Studio, they're really trying to extend the brand out to people who, you know, may need to just do some photo retouching, do some red eye reduction, but they don't want to go out to the, you know, through the whole process and you know, install an application and things like that. So I see there's definitely probably a need for this, but I think some of the diehard Photoshop folks will probably look at it and think it's neat, but they'll probably pass it by.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there. I wonder if this is going to be compatible with the iPhone at all. I don't even know how you would do this with an iPhone.
Yeah.
Well, if it uses stuff like Flash or Air, that stuff doesn't run on the iPhone at the moment, so you probably won't be able to use it.
The big news last week was the Adobe CEO saying that they're going to put Flash on the iPhone with or without Apple's help.
Yeah, don't let the CEOs talk to the media unbriefed, I think, is the lesson there.
Yeah.
Yeah, make sure you talk to those dev guys.
Yeah, well, and the PR people are in the back room pulling out their hair going, what did he just say? Probably not a good idea.
Yeah, so
the next guy will come on and say, well, what he really meant was.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're going to need Apple's cooperation, really, to because Flash has so many pieces to it. It has, you know, it could communicate with IP devices, and there's just so many things it could do. They really probably need Apple's help to get it on there.
Yep. Speaking of the iPhone, Lee, I see that you posted a blog up on mymac.com about Apple releasing a new beta of the WebKit the developing kit for the iPhone.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I got my email today after registering for the I've been an ADC member for, you know, almost a decade, maybe longer. And, you know, I got my email today, and they have a new update, downloaded it. The thing I really wanted to spend some time with is the interface builder. One thing Apple kind of does in their development is they cycle from one like Mac OS X kind of led the user experience for a lot of Apple applications, and now we're seeing some user experience that comes from iPhone making its way back into OS X. So seeing the interface builder and what Apple has in store for SDK kind of gives us a peek at what we're going to look at, you know, post Leopard.
Does that surprise you that some of the development going into the iPhone is going to make its way back to the Mac?
I don't see it as a surprise at all. Apple's doing. I've been reading. I read a really cool article. It was South by Southwest. A guy, I forgot his name, but he wrote about how Apple they rotate people within the company to sort of keep the creative juices flowing, so people don't get stuck and feel like they, you know. I think it comes from the Pixar way of doing things. You know, people who are IT guys are taking sculpting classes, and people
right.
who are, you know, it's to cross-pollinate creative abilities throughout the company. So Apple's kind of doing that. I could definitely see Apple using some of the ideas. I mean, you see multi-touch on the new MacBooks. It's all kind of coming around.
Yeah, it is. Although multi-touch was kind of with the dual scrolling on the first generation of MacBook Pros,
yep.
they kind of had that already, and that kind of went to the iPhone.
Yeah, definitely. The two-finger scrolling and...
Yeah.
You can see...
I can't use a laptop without that now. Something's wrong with this laptop. The page isn't... What's going on?
Yeah, it's really easy to get used to something like that. But yeah, I got my CocoaBook. I'm an old comp sci guy who went in the business side of things, but I really do like... it's a hobby for me.
Yeah.
Now, Lee, obviously you've got... You know, with you know, and you've got people in your team who are looking at iPhone development. I mean, without obviously, without giving away any company secrets. I mean, how are they finding the development process so far? Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I think everybody who's, especially people who are new to the, you know, the Mac platform. There's some of the older developers who remember the old Mac toolbox and
sure.
building things, and, you know, with MantraWorks Code Warrior and all that. But I think people are pleasantly surprised how good the tools are. You know, Apple using the GCC compilers, the Xcode is an unbelievable IDE. And picking up Objective-C is something that, you know, even within our group, you know, we have some guys who've never programmed on the Mac, and making the transition was really easy. So Steve Jobs loves touting how fast, and especially during our during the March 6th announcement, one of our developers, Rizwan, got up there on stage, and he said that, you know, he's never written a line of code in Objective-C. and in 2 weeks they were able to port it over. So Steve loves hearing stuff like that. And the whole reason Next picked Objective-C as their development environment is for that reason. You could really pretty much pick up the SDK, pick up a book, and start coding within a week.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, if you have some programming experience too.
Right.
Well, that helps a little bit. Some big news for me this last week, and this actually happened last Thursday, the day that we recorded the last podcast, but I didn't talk about it, was I had a big delivery day from Apple. I had the Apple TV 2.0 software pre-installed. I had the Apple TV delivered. I got the 160 gig.
Sweet.
And I also got the 1 terabyte time capsule.
Excellent.
And for the two 13-year-old girls and my wife, they all got a refurbished MacBook. Each one of them got their own.
Oh, great.
So
very nice.
So it was nice. I've got to get them something sometimes. I mean, you know, they put up with all this Mac crap from me that, you know, occasionally they get to get something.
Well, what were they using before?
My wife has an older Dell PC that I'm still making payments on.
Oh, no.
And, she uses that quite a bit, and she needed that because she uses Visio at work, so she has to have a PC. And she always wanted a laptop. So this round, I decided I was going to get her a laptop. I was looking at the price. 2 gigahertz MacBooks were $849 or so.
Wow.
So I got three of them, and the two 13-year-old girls, they're 6 months apart. Obviously, one's mine, one's Julie's, and then we have ours, four kids all together. For those who's doing the math and going, wait a minute, that doesn't work.
Six
two
months.
13-year-olds, wow, she's got a short incubation period. So they are really taking to the MacBook like 13-year-old girls would. They love it. What they really like, and I was kind of surprised about this, we also got the see-through case from Casemate, who makes those now?
Spec.
Thank you very much. I've got one sitting here.
Yeah.
Spec sent us. We're going to do a video review, and I'm actually going to let the girls get on video to do this. Putting these cases on the MacBooks. We've got 5 different colors, so the girls both picked out 2 of them for themselves, and the dark blue one that was left went to my wife. So they're having a whole lot of fun with the MacBooks. I'm having a ton of fun ripping all my DVDs over to my hard drive on the computer. Some of them are going directly to the Apple TV. The other ones I'm just going to stream live from an external. Yep. And well, I did what I've really listened to Lee in the last couple of shows when he was talking about the, thank you, Lee, by the way, you're the one that got me into this damn thing.
Sure.
Option copying them into iTunes,
yep.
So it will link them, but it won't actually copy the entire file. That's great, by the way. It works really well. I've got an external 250 and an external 160 gigabyte hard drives that are linking on my iTunes movies. And, you know, with the N network and the time capsule, even a 3 gigabyte movie is streaming. No problem at all. No hiccups. It's only like, you know, 20 feet away. But still, I mean, it is wireless, so that's kind of nice.
How was your setup with the time capsule? I'm interested because I just picked up a time capsule 1 terabyte last week, too.
Yeah, it gave me a lot of problems, to be honest. When you first plug it in, if you've already been running an Airport Extreme, mm-hmm. which I was, it came up and says, do you want to set up a brand new network or do you want it to copy the configuration from the old one and it just becomes that?
Yep.
So I chose that option. And it worked fine for all the Macs in the house.
Mm-hmm.
The iPhone saw it, the Macintosh, my MacBook Pro saw it, the MacBook saw it, everything saw it just fine. But none of my gaming systems did. The PS3 wouldn't see it, the Wii didn't see it, and neither did the PS or the Xbox 360.
Interesting.
Nothing I did would work. I did get the the PS3 to work. That eventually saw the network and would join it.
Mm-hmm.
But neither the Wii or the 360 would join the N network no matter what. It did not like the time capsule.
Hmm.
It refused to join. The funny thing is though that the PS3 actually saw that there was a hard drive. A NAS attached to it. So it saw the 1 terabyte drive inside
the
network. No. The PS3 would eventually.
Oh, okay.
But the other two machines would not see it no matter what. So what I did is I slaved my old Airport Extreme to it,
mm-hmm.
and extended the network that way. And the Wii and the 360 use that network connection to get on the line. And the PS3 and everything else uses the new time capsule.
Yeah, that's what I sort of did. I had a couple of Airport Expresses that I scattered around. So the Wii picks up on that network since it's sitting right next to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that does come in handy. I was really happy that Apple released the new Time Capsule firmware and the new Airport Extreme software, so that helped out a lot.
Yeah, that was the first thing that I did after I was having all these problems. I updated it, but it still didn't help the 360 or the Wii get on the network with the new Time Capsule. It just would not do it.
So they just won't see end networks?
Well, the Time Capsule will do, you know, A, B, and G as well. But no matter what I chose in the airport utility, they would not see it. I don't know why.
I don't think,
and I did everything.
I don't think the airport utility is a particularly fantastic piece of software.
No, they're horrible. I think it's horrible.
The problem is that there's an awful lot of stuff it's doing automatically in the background, and it doesn't expose to you what it's doing.
Exactly. If there was an advanced, you know, expert settings, I probably could have got it to work. Exactly. But you don't have that option.
No. And so, you know, if it goes automatic and something doesn't work, you basically are stuffed. You just have to try. Sometimes on mine, I've tried sort of dumping everything and setting it up again, and sometimes you resolve problems that way. But it is frustrating.
One of the things that I do like about the Apple TV, of course, I'm watching all my movies on there now, so that's great. Mm-hmm. TV shows I'm not really into yet, but I'm going to see how that works. I do have a question for you, Lee. I haven't done this. Have you ripped any TV shows to your Apple TV?
Yeah, I'm right in the middle of I purchased all three box sets of the original Star Trek episodes.
Uh-huh.
So I'm doing that.
The remastered ones?
No, I started buying them before that came out, and then I was like, oh. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
But I also had some pretty good luck. I use the ITV. I use the ITV hybrid USB thing.
And oh, okay, yeah.
I do a lot of show recording there. I used to spend a lot of time going in ITV's editor and pulling out, cleaning it up, trimming it up, but it took too long, so I just dump the whole show on nowadays.
My question is, does Apple TV see that, or more specifically, does iTunes see that as a television show, or does it see it as in a movie?
Well, that's the interesting thing. When you get an Apple TV, one thing you'll notice, especially when you get to like 140 DVDs ripped, your movie directory is really, really long.
Yeah.
So you could actually cheat a little, and if you use Meta X, you could designate it as a television show.
Yep.
So you could take a movie, tell it it's a television show, so you could take all your Disney or Pixar films, put them together, bunch them together as a instead of calling season 2 or something like that, you call them season Pixar. And it organizes them on the Apple TV into seasons so that they lump them together, which is kind of nice.
I've got 165 DVDs ripped now.
Wow.
Wow, that was fast.
And about 120 of them, well, I've been doing this for a couple weeks, though, Guy. I knew that I was going to get the Apple TV, so I'm going to jump ahead.
I've been working on 8 months.
So I've got about 160 or so ripped. About 120 of them are actually on the hard drive on the Apple TV.
Right.
And those are the ones that I know for a fact I'm going to watch over and over and over.
Yeah.
But I've been holding off doing the television shows, like the whole Firefly series. I want to get that on there.
Mm-hmm. What a great!
But
show.
I didn't want I didn't want each episode to show up as a movie on the Apple TV.
Yeah, just make sure in Meta X you designate it as a TV show instead of a movie, and it'll group them for you. But one thing you have to do too is when you're in the Apple TV interface, you have to go up to the top, and there's two sorting options. It'll let you sort by series.
Ah, that will help.
So that'll lump them all together and keeps, you know, especially I have 73 episodes of Star Trek. You kind of want to keep those together.
Yes, absolutely. You don't want those to fall in with, you know, all the West Wings and everything else and that's in
and
there.
And my 40 episodes of Backyardigans.
There you go. Yeah, I'm going to have a lot of those type of things myself. But, you know, that's the price we pay.
just to let you know, Lee, I'm going out to the States to visit my parents in a couple of weeks, and I have a refurb 160 gig Apple TV waiting for me when I get there as well on your on your recommendation. So
it's
well,
great.
I'm going to get the recommendation now as well.
Am I like the odd guy out here again with the Apple TV, with the iPhone?
Well, I don't think it's because of the technology that you're the odd guy out guy, but, you know, we'll use that as an excuse for now.
Okay, hey, I'm wearing my pants.
Lee has no idea what that means yet. Well, he will when he listens
to
the show back.
He will.
So I'm using Handbrake, obviously, and I took your advice, Lee, for the shows that I didn't. I use the Apple TV settings for, you know, Lord of the Rings stuff and Star Wars. But for all the kids' shows, the Pixar movies, stuff like that, I'm using the iPhone setting, the preset. And I have to say, you know, I was watching Monsters with the 4-year-old earlier, and I'm very discriminating when it comes to quality on video, especially on the HD TV. Mm-hmm. I'm really impressed with the way that the Apple TV seems to be upscaling that video and presenting it in HD. I mean, it looks pretty darn good.
Yeah, whatever Apple, I have to go back to the break, you know, the teardowns of what people are saying, but the graphic scalers they're using to scale it up to HD.
They're fantastic.
Excellent.
I mean, the H.264 encoding is obviously doing a lot of that as well, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, I mean, that's a small little video file, under a gigabyte for the most part. And it looks darn good.
Oh, I do have one tip for people listening. If you're using Handbrake, which is one of my favorite all-time programs ever, make sure you keep a copy of version 091 and 092 on the hard drives at the same time. I found out some DVDs have problems with 092, and if you experience any crashing while you're trying to do a rip, try 091. It usually will work.
I had that exact problem today, as a matter of fact. I was trying to rip the first Godfather movie, and it was taking forever, and it finally crashed out on me, and I opened up the old version, yep. and it ripped it just fine.
Yeah, there's some new stuff that they're doing to support the Take-Two software, so you could do surround sound. I'm wondering if some of the codecs that they have in the new one tend to be a little unstable sometimes.
You know, the audio is coming through really, really well, even better than the picture on some of these encodings. I mean, I'm really amazed. And, of course, this is the iPhone setting in Handbrake, and I'm getting true surround sound, stuff that I know for a fact, like the race car. This is kind of my test on an HD system mm-hmm. with surround sound. I put in Days of Thunder, and there's one part, and I know we've all had that guilty pleasure. We've all seen that stupid movie, and it is a stupid movie. Yeah. When he is driving the other race car driver's car for the first time around the track, yeah. and he goes, "I'm dropping the hammer," and he goes, "You know you're not," and he does. But what I really like about this, and I always skip right to that part when I'm testing a system, is because the sound of the car starts really loud in front of you, and then it literally travels all the way around you. It sounds very lifelike.
Oh, great!
And that's what I used to test the Apple TV with, ripping it with Handbrake, and it came out perfectly. It sounds just great.
Oh, excellent.
So that's my little surround sound tip for people. If you're looking for something to test your system with, that one works really well. Unfortunately, you have to buy this stupid movie to get it, but, you know. Somebody should come out with
excuse me.
Yeah, well, no. I these people spent a lot of money to make these movies. I don't think it's right for people to just download them for free and watch them and
well, no, I'm just saying, pay just for get them. That one little bit so you can test your setup. Don't bother with the rest of the movie.
Nicole Kidman's in it, so it's not all
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's a good part of it.
You know, one thing I also use is the THX optimizer that Pixar puts on all their DVDs.
Yep.
That comes in handy sometimes, too.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of stuff going on up at mymac.com right now. I don't know if you guys have been following what's going on, but Scott, one of our new reviewers, has actually reviewed the Apple TV, and it's with the Take-Two software, and he gave it a 4 out of 5. I think I'd agree with that. I don't think it's a perfect product yet, Lee. Do you?
No, I think it needs a couple of things. My favorite, my biggest thing is I wish it would not use so much electricity. The thing's warm all the time.
Yes, it is really warm. I will say that. That's one of the things that kind of bothers me. It's sitting right on top of my HDMI switcher, mm-hmm. and it kind of worries me that it's sitting on top of that thing. I'm like, oh.
Is that even when you put it in standby, does it stay hot?
It's toasty. You can put your coffee on top and keep it warm.
Yeah, definitely. That and I don't like that myself, but other than that, I like it. I think it's a nice machine.
Yeah, then we get 5 out of 5 if they worked a little more on, you know, when you get a 160-gig unit, just managing your media that's on there, make it easier to find. Because my kids are sitting there thumbing through 120 titles, and, you know, it's tough.
I wish that you could create video playlists mm-hmm. that would show up on the main screen.
Yep.
So you can go to movies and then your playlists, like you do in iTunes. I think, again, that would be very, very helpful, because when you're starting to scroll through all those movies...
Yeah, have like
and it's
action,
not just the ones,
action playlist, comedy playlist.
Right, right. I forgot that iTunes literally has to be running on the machine that's serving up the videos that's not on the Apple TV that's sharing it over the network. Because my daughter was watching Monsters, like I said, and I went and I quit iTunes into my computer, and she went... Hey, the movie stopped. And I was like, oh, crap. So I fired up iTunes, went back to the Apple TV. It saw it again. And I hit play, and it picked up right where it left off.
Well, if you have your content on a different drive than the drive that has iTunes on it, can't you point the Apple TV to that drive?
No, because it's sharing through iTunes, not the computer itself.
Okay.
I would give it 5 out of 5 if Apple would let stored content on Time Capsule or Share Drive let the Apple TV talk to it directly.
That's one of the reasons that I got the Time Capsule thinking I could do that, but you can't.
Well, could be because that the Apple TV, you can set up like your own, you know, without using a computer, set up your own account to get content from Apple?
I think that's more about renting movies and buying movies than anything else.
I think Apple.
And I did that too. I actually bought music. I bought a music video. Mm-hmm.
But you can't move that into iTunes.
Sure, I can. As soon as I launched iTunes, turned on the computer, it synced back.
Oh, really?
And it works just like it does with an iPhone, where if you buy a song on your iPhone or an iPod Touch through the Apple's Wi-Fi store, the next time you sync it to your computer, it automatically puts the content in your iTunes. Does the same thing with the Apple TV.
Nice.
Okay, I had heard that it hadn't done that. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it does it. It does it, and it does it really well. And it was seamless. I bought a Paula Abdul music video that my wife liked. That's what it was.
So if you rent a movie, will it won't do the same with that to your computer? But
no, because it's not your content.
Will it allow you to see that rented movie on your iPhone, say?
Yes.
Right. So
sure, and you could watch it on the computer too until the time expires.
Yeah, within 24 hours, you could tell it to I want to transfer my viewing to this device.
Okay. Yep. All right.
Cool. But then the whole file moves, doesn't it? You now can't watch it through Apple TV.
Yes. Well, it's like the permissions, I think. It's probably still sitting there. It just says you can't watch it right now because some other device is going to be playing it back.
Yep. I am a little concerned about the longevity of the device as far as the heat and being a hard drive in there. What happens when that hard drive dies? Yeah. That does kind of concern me a little bit.
You can change the drive, though.
Oh, yeah, it's not too hard to change the drive. And I've had my 40 gig running for months and months and months, 24 hours a day, and it seems to be holding up.
Yeah. So far, I've got to say that I'm really impressed with it, but I do agree with Scott's score of 4 out of 5. It's a good device. I like it a lot. David Weeks did a couple of iPhone book reviews that's up on the site. He also did a Bodyguards for iPhone that's an iPod or iPhone case. And finally, we've got some Microsoft Office 2008 content up on the site after, I kind of meant to get something written myself at this point, but the problem is it keeps crashing on me. And so Owen Rubin did the review of, in the first look, kind of, first impressions of Word 2008. I agreed with everything he wrote. Microsoft, by the way, also sent me a new copy of Office 2008 because the version I had was the reviewer's copy that I downloaded from their servers about a month before Macworld Expo. And when I went to apply the new update to Office, it didn't work. It said, you don't have a copy of Office on this computer to update. And I'm like, right there, dude. So they sent me an actual boxed copy, so I'm going to install that eventually and see if that takes care of the problems that I was having.
Oh, great.
David, you have Office as well, correct?
I do, and I must admit, I've not looked at it recently. I know they issued the update. I've not had time to install it, principally because, you know, I use Office for work an awful lot, and I need to be able to rely on it. So I've been falling back to 2004, so I know where I am. So I must get around to reinstalling it and putting the new update on and see if it sorts the bug. The crashing issues that I was having. I mean, it's interesting. Owen said he'd had no problems with it at all. So
yeah, but I'm wondering if that was before or after the update, because he does have his update.
Yeah.
So mine crashes all the time. So I'm hoping that, not being a huge Office user anymore, I've kind of moved on a little bit.
Yeah.
I still want it, when I do use it, I still want it to be as stable as possible. That'd be kind of nice.
So, I mean, see, for me, it was interesting reading Owen's article, because he's come at it very much from somebody creating new documents with Word. I mean, he focused very much on Word, and he likes a lot of the new features because they can make new documents look very good. For me, I'm coming from the situation where I'm sharing documents with other users, and
Yours is more of a workflow.
Exactly.
Issue.
The templates are already there, and you know, a lot of the features they've taken away with this version of Office caused some problems. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, once I get to see.
Definitely pros and cons there, this is David Weeks' week, I guess I should say, at MyMac.com, because another two reviews from him, the Macintosh iLife 08, you know, that book keeps coming out every year from Jim Hyde. And everything I've read about it, I did the first one he did. It was just called iLife. But he updates this book every time a new iLife comes out. And it's really a must-have book. If you're a big iLife user, this is the book to have to learn everything you can learn about that suite of applications. And he also did an iPod Repair Quick Steps review. That's a book. And four different reviews from David Weeks this week. That's
busy boy.
I guess Weeks, that's his last name. this is his week. And John Nemirovsky did an iPod Classic case roundup. Bunch of different cases that you can get for your iPod Classic. And last but not least, Chad Perry. He did a review of the Naja King stand for iPod. That's from our friends at Thought Out Biz. And he gave it a 4.5 out of 5. That's kind of a neat looking product. It's like a snake. He's actually got pictures of himself wearing this thing around his neck to play with his
touch. That was a great review he did, I thought. In fact,
on
the back of the review, just before we start the podcast, I went online and ordered myself one of those. So
it looks like a real nice. I haven't been over to Chad's house lately to take a look at it, but I kind of want to see it myself because this might be something I want for my iPhone.
He's even got my name in it.
Yes, he does. So, so thanks very much to Chad. We're going to have Chad back on the podcast here pretty soon. It's been a long time since Chad's been on now, and I'm kind of missing Chad. We need to bring him back, have him on the show again to get caught up with what he's doing, playing with his new touch. That doesn't sound right.
goes along with the rest of the theme of this podcast, though.
There you go. So anything else going on with David Cohen?
I've got a pile of stuff that I'm working through on review. Just sent you a review today of the black box speaker from...
Yeah, that was that case that we saw at the Macworld Expo. We went to the briefing at the
hotel.
That's
right, and this is it's a very funky-looking set of speakers that's got a Bluetooth radio built in, and they do a little Bluetooth dongle so you can basically use it wirelessly with your iPod. It's quite an interesting setup. Part of me really likes it, part of me had some problems with it, you know, in terms of the overall sound quality, but it's an interesting product, and it was interesting to review something that's a little bit different from so many of the iPod speakers, accessories you see nowadays.
I remember it being more, hey, that's cool, more than, hey, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and that's very much, and in fact, I'll mention this in the review, but a couple of people I spoke to about it, you know, they'd seen it in stores, they'd seen it on the web, and you know, it very much stuck in their memory, and they were very interested to hear what my experiences were. So it is very much something a little bit different for iPod speakers, so that's quite good.
Last week we talked with Don McAllister from Screencast Online. He was giving a presentation somewhere, and I understand that you went and visited
him. Yeah, he lives in Liverpool. I live in Manchester, and he was doing a presentation in Warrington, which is a small town sort of halfway between the two. So on Tuesday I headed over there and saw him. He was talking about his experiences with – it was really like a primer on what podcasting is and what screencasting is and how anybody can do it, you know, and really running through the tools. It was very interesting, actually. There was probably about 30-40 people there listening to this talk, and he, of course, he was showing off all the tools on the Mac, and you know, at the end of the presentation, somebody would put their hand up and say, well, that's really good, but you know, how do I do this if I'm running Windows, or can I do this if I'm running Windows? And he was at pains to say that, you know, yes, this is not purely a Mac thing, but you know, the Mac makes it very easy. And I talked to a couple of people afterwards, and they were very enthused by his talk. He's really got a fantastic presentation style. It was a very good talk.
Did you actually get to meet him?
I did. I had a brief chat with him while we had lunch afterwards, and it was good to meet him in person. It was funny. I walked in slightly late because the timing I'd been sent was a little bit wrong, and he recognised me straight away from my Twitter photo and sort of said, "Oh, hey, David, come and sit down." And then just sort of said, "Oh, David's another podcaster," and so I had a couple of people come up and talk to me afterwards as well.
Oh, that was great. So he actually went through steps on how to make a podcast.
He did. In fact, he actually using iWeb and GarageBand, he actually did a small podcast actually as part of his demonstration and put it up on a website.
Did you take notes? That might be something I might be interested in putting this podcast thing together.
I think he might have a screencast that you could watch on that.
It couldn't hurt, trust me. Guy Searle, what's going on in your life? Any Mac news? Anything that you're playing with that that's Mac related. The listeners would be interested in. I mean, obviously, you're still working on the iWeb stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, work. You know, my regular gig has been kind of crazy lately with the quarter. You know, end of the quarter coming up. So I really haven't had time to do anything that's like super cool Mac related, other than, you know, just trying to get used to and loving that 2.33 MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I've got the 2.0, but those are nice machines. I really like them. You know what happened with mine? My power plug is shot on the Mac Lite is shot on the MacBook Pro.
All you can really do is buy a new one, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, but I happen to have three new MacBooks here. So I'm just using my wife's power plug when I need to charge mine up, so that's always a nice thing.
Well, you have to know the battery for it, too, as well, don't you?
The battery's fine. That's not the problem. The problem is I can't charge it because the Mag Lite, right where it goes into the brick, is fried. It looks like it literally burnt through.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen a few people post articles about that, the MagSafe's burning.
So it happened to me. I've always tried to take really good care of it, but obviously, you know, it's on the floor and it gets stepped on. But it doesn't look like it was ripped. It looks like it burnt through. So I'm hesitant to use it at this point. Yeah, I could put some electrical tape around it, but nevertheless, it's kind of one of those things that it's like, well, do I cough up $70 to get a brand new one, or do I simply use one of the three that's in the house at any one time? So I'm thinking right now I'm just going to use my wife's until I've got $70 burning a hole in my pocket that I really don't need, which should be in 2012.
Maybe see if you can send it to Apple. Maybe they'll repair it for less than $70.
I don't know if they would actually repair it. I don't know.
Is it out of warranty?
Yeah, unfortunately. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. Lee Gibbons, what's going on in the Mac world for you?
Well, we're still getting over the euphoria of having Steve Jobs invite us on stage. And, you know, it's been 17 days. I'm still pretty happy about it. But for me, I've just been spending a lot of time playing with my time capsule, trying to figure out the best backup scenarios for all the different machines. And, I've also finally taken I waited for the first update. So I'm playing with Mac, the new Microsoft Office 2008. Spending some time trying to figure that out and seeing how I could fit that into my workflow is, you know, all
it's
day.
It's pretty.
Long.
I'll give it that. It's a pretty new version of the application.
Yeah, I've had some pretty good luck with some of the older. I do a lot of PowerPoints, of course, being a product person. So, we're trying to actually move a lot of our presentations over to Keynote.
There's a lot of third-party themes and stuff for Keynote that's really fantastic out there, because personally I'm getting a little bit sick of the built-in themes that Apple provides with Keynote. I'm getting to the point now where I see one, I'm like, that's Keynote. You know, there's a lot of development going on right now for third-party plugins for it. Well, not plugins, but themes.
Yeah, I think Apple's finally getting to the point, you know, with Mail App allowing you to do stationery and all the different themes and all the third parties that are coming out with unique things. So I think it's a pretty good ecosystem Apple's put together.
As for me, I've got a lot of products getting sent my way, and I'm falling farther and farther behind. I'm actually still halfway through writing my Periscope review. But just this week, I got this little video camera called the Flip. Have you guys seen this thing yet?
I've heard about it.
That's got like a built-in USB plug,
yeah, you just push this little button, and this little USB plug slides out to the side of the unit. And really what it looks like is a digital camera, but you hold it vertically rather than horizontally, and it records 1 hour of video.
Yeah, the folks in our marketing corporate communications, they love the Flip. I see them all over every AOL event. They have the Flips out recording, you know, spontaneous video.
A couple things I don't like about it. Number one, it outputs in a format that I have to convert using Media Hub.
Yep.
It won't play natively on the Macintosh, but that's a minor gripe. Nowadays, with video, it's real easy to convert this stuff, so I'm not going to downgrade my score any for that, and I really haven't played with it a whole lot. Number two, I don't see how I can increase the memory in this thing. Maybe there's a way, I just haven't figured it out yet. But I don't see how I can put more flash memory in this thing so I can get more than an hour's worth of recording. It does run on two AA batteries, which I would really rather have it charged via the USB. But the biggest gripe for me is there's no way to cover
the lens.
It's just there. There's no cover for it, and I don't like that a bit because it's going to get dirty. If you got this thing in a backpack or your computer bag and you pull it out, you're going to put your thumb right on the lens, and you're going to get smudges. But, you know, this is like $149, I think, these things cost. And so far, I'm kind of impressed with it. I handed it to my 13. Quality is not bad. You'll see that when we do the review.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm actually thinking about doing with the review, I'm thinking about doing a video review and actually standing in front of a mirror with it. You know, do that and maybe break out the Canon GL2 a little bit so I can show you the back and, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, but, you can get really creative with the mirrors then.
You know, it's really kind of neat. It's got a very small screen on it, but it's just fine for what you're doing. I mean, it is a cheap little video camera, and the quality is surprisingly good, surprisingly. So I've been playing with that. It's a company called Razer, who I've never heard of before. They sent me, let me pull it down so I get the names right. They sent me a gaming mouse. It's called the ProClick Mobile, and it's a Bluetooth mouse, so that will work with my iMac or any of my laptops sitting around here. And they also sent me this thing called the Destructor. It's the professional gaming mat. Now, I was thinking this is just some kind of a mouse pad. This thing is as long as my keyboard. I have no idea how I'm going to use this thing or where I'm even going to put it to test, but it looks pretty good. I haven't even opened it yet. It says, and you got to love some of the PR that they put on these products, 37% better tracking over other gaming grade surfaces.
Yeah, I'd like to see the metrics for that. What is a gaming grade surface?
Well, let's see, what does it say? It's the Razer, co-developed with the world's leading pro gamers.
When they say 37%, though, you can just imagine they have this lab with these, you know, these twitchy, high caffeine gamers who are there with
I really like it. You know?
I got a much higher kill rate with this. I get the headshot straight time.
here's the leading pro gamers for you, guy. Jesse Corban Ryan. He's with Team EG. And his quote on the package is, "We're psyched to have been involved in testing the Razer Destructor, and we're looking forward to using it in all of our future matches."
No, you need to use the voice, Tim.
We're psyched to have him involved. Well, he's a pro gamer, right?
Yeah.
So those are some of the products. And I'm still way behind on my headphone reviews. And I've got one company calling and calling and calling. I don't know how they got my phone number. It must be in my email somewhere. About this unsolicited, by the way. And I hate it once companies send me stuff unsolicited. In other words, I didn't ask to review this. They just sent it and go, "Are you going to review it? Are you going to review it? Are you going to review it?" It's from Plan On. It's called the DocuPen Portable Scanner. It's like twice as long as a ballpoint pen, and it's a scanner. You take it with you, and you scan documents and pictures and everything. And it looks kind of cool, but it's like, you know, when I get to it, I'll review the damn thing. But stop calling me. You're going to get a half a score just for, you know, pestering me. But, you know, thanks for sending it. Maybe it's cool. Maybe it's not. I don't know yet. Haven't really had a chance to look at it. You know, I'm drooling over my pro gaming mat right now. I gotta,
What was that product again?
That problem was the Razer Destructor. It might be cool. I'm making fun of it, but it actually does look kind of cool. For professional gaming mat, you know.
Yeah.
Not wrestling, you know. It's not for professional wrestling type of mat. It's a gaming mat as in video games. So
right.
Any professional wrestlers out there listening, and I know there used to be one, I'm not going to say who, but he actually sent me email once, and I said, "Hey, you want to come on the show?" And he was like, "Hey, no, I don't." I said, "Okay." But he was a professional wrestler in the WWE. It was
WWE now.
Right. But this wrestler is now with some other wrestling company. I don't know. It's something down in Nashville or something. But he used to listen to all the time, and it's kind of weird knowing that someone that's in professional wrestling is listening to a Mac podcast. But I think that kind of goes to the demographic of Mac users is literally everyone. I don't think nowadays there is one single demographic that, you know, oh, it's just professional or it's just this type of person. It's just the mom and pops. It's just that that doesn't exist anymore in the Mac world.
Yeah, I think that's going to even get better. I just read a report today that Morgan Stanley is reporting 40% of higher education, 40% of college students are buying Macs.
Mm-hmm. They're cool again.
It's back.
It is. Last thing I want to touch on for my Mac is, of course, we did the update with the graphics, so we are back to My Mac Magazine instead of just MyMac.com. It's probably going to take me a long time to get used to saying My Mac Magazine again. But I put this new Flash player up on the site, so anybody going up to the site wanting to listen to the podcast, if you looked on to the bottom left of your screen when you're at MyMac.com, this little gray thing sticks out, and it actually is a playlist. Any MP3s, which is obviously what these podcasts are, will play right in that player. So right now you can see show 174, 175, 176, and you'll see 177 once I get this posted. And you can listen to it right there. It's kind of cool. So check it out. Anybody got anything else before we wrap this baby up?
No, nothing.
Nope.
I'm good.
I want to thank Dave Hamilton for coming on the show. Of course, John Nemirovsky and David Weeks for their segment. Robert Hazelrig for sending in all that cool Adobe Photoshop information. He knew about it over a couple weeks ago, so I'm a little jealous that he got some insider info. Lee, thanks for coming on the show. I know that you came in a little bit late, and you know, you're spending time away from the family to be on. We do appreciate it.
Sure.
And Guy, of course, thank you very much for coming on.
And being whoever it is I am.
And and David Cohen, you can put your clothes back on now. The show's over.
Actually, he's going to bed. He's got his PJs on.
You're assuming that that's PJs.
Oh, well, yeah.
He just has very wrinkly skin. next week, we've got a challenger to Lee Gibbons' Mac collection. We're going to have Gil on, Gil Polson of MyMac.com. He's one of our new writers. And he actually has a museum in his basement of Mac computers. Did I send you guys the link?
No.
I will have to do that. He's got a .Mac account up with pictures of his little Mac museum. It's not little. It's really cool. And so next week after the show, look for show 178, the links. You'll find pictures of his Mac museum, and it'll make Lee kind of drool. And
I'm already
start putting his.
I'm already jealous. Already doing.
It's pretty cool. Your mission this week is to hit eBay and try and beat him.
That's right. I was looking on eBay myself this week, and I was looking in vintage Macs, and one of them was the AOL System 08 preview or something like that. It was when Apple released what Mac OS 8 is going to look like, which never materialized, at least in that form. But it came with an AOL disc, so I thought that was kind of cool. I thought Lee should be bidding on this.
Oh, that's
he's probably got 150,000 of them at AOL headquarters still.
Actually, I do have some of my old Copeland Mac OS 8 discs sitting around.
Yeah.
Those are the days.
I tell you. Okay, we'll be back next week with show 178. Bye-bye.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.